They also have things like parades. I'm not sure whether it was that time or the next time, but we were in several of some sort of unions, and we had to have an escort, a company escort, and I was the escort commander, and I've got a photograph. And then there was after the parade, there was a sort of big party we had to get together. And then we had to go back to get ready to go.
The Americans put any entertainment on for you at this point?
Not the Americans, yes. I suppose the Aussies were the people who used to do most of the entertaining as far as I was concerned. They were likewise for them. I would imagine that the Americans did, but the Americans took things so seriously that they very seldom relaxed to that extent. We amazed them in that they were so relaxed when it wasn't necessary for the old head up for it. There were lots and lots of examples of that, one of them being the parties that we used to have back at the hotel in headquarters while we were in the line even. But out of the line, of course, it was great. And the Aussies were always marvellous at it because they were very pleasant shooters. But you went to there, and then
there, so each for all meat, steaks, pheasants. They were just marvellous. And they found a way, we eventually copied them, of getting the beer cold. They buried it under the ground, and we eventually did that too.
How long were you in reserve?
Oh, dear me. I think we were there in about 2 or 3 weeks, I think. We had a lift time.
And then you went back into the land, in the same position?
The same position, yes.
And you were now in 8th?
Yes, I was in 8th.
Can you describe these positions?
Well, on that occasion, I think we were in reserve, but we were living in Hoochie's as if we were in the front line. Not a lot different to what it was like in the modern film, really. There was 3 platoons linked by various communication trenches, or trenches linked to the company headquarters. I was part of company headquarters. Two ICs, other companies, they tended to place themselves back at A echelon and dealt with the administration. And I asked Pat Donahue if that's what he wanted me to do. He said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I would like to stay up here and I would like to take an active part in the patrolling. Because I said, I haven't had any experience in, I would like to get.
So he said, that's fine, yes. He said, as long as the administration doesn't slip, you do that. So that was the situation from then on. I shared the command with him, with had my own, sleeping in that for me. I took an active part in the day-to-day running of the company in the line. Every now and again, I have to go back to the AS to make sure that the telephone
is doing the job properly and that sort of thing. In fact, I think I annoyed Peter Jeffries on that occasion because it seemed to me that we weren't getting the rations
that we should have been getting. And I made inquiries here, there, everywhere. And eventually came up with the solution that the telephone wasn't producing the rations we should for whatever reason. And he
complained to the CO about the fact that I was inquiring about it. And Peter got me up and inquired into the whole thing and asked me why I did it myself. And I said, we're not getting the fashion that we should be getting. I said, I was checking with the other companies to see what we should be getting. And it seemed to me that there was something missing. We weren't getting anything that we should. So he except for Len Fuchsia, Joe Barrett, and Norbert and Alec Manning.
Can you describe your daily duties as to I see in that?
Well, my personal daily duties, well, mainly they revolve around patrolling. Do patrolling at night, you slept most of the day after the patrol. And you only did whatever was necessary later on in the day as far as it was possible.
If you were going out on patrol, you had to prepare for it, get briefed the people you were taking out with you, make sure that the weapons were in the weapons order, make sure the kit was all there, the proper color flag, and that sort of thing. And then you went out, did your stuff, came back. And usually, after having swapped them out and checked and see if they make sure the weapons were reasonably stripped and disarmed, you went to bed and you stayed there until you woke up virtually. If you weren't on patrol, then I used to see to the administration in the line, and I used to the platoons were keeping their positions tidy and clean. The discipline was right. Morale was okay. Suggesting and helping possibly with various improvements that could be done. White tape, for instance, for my people, put that out and help to get from A to B. After a while, of course, you got used to which direction and where the tape went to. Meals, serving the meals, making sure that everybody was got a hot meal. We had two cook houses by that time. Make sure. We had them on the front line of front. The Americans couldn't have. Because they used to get cold food, hot food started, and by the time we got to them, we were absolutely frozen.
So you cooked up in the front line?
And they always had, like the mash, they had a big tray which had all sorts of everything would be bundled out with that, and you get food mixed up with gravy and that. Terrible.
We also had a canteen up on the line that soldiers could use, but it's a little restricted as far as the putting on
comfort. I think they were allowed one bottle a day or something. But the canteen was there, there were sweets and chocolates and cigarettes and this sort of thing. PRI Rotten Aid, they stocked the canteen. And each company gave their canteen a name, and one of them was a Habano Club, which is clear for tomorrow, I think. But anyway, there was plenty to do. Yes. Not in the reserve, usually. There were trenches there, but you usually use footpaths to take.
And the reserve position was where in relation to the front line and the rear?
Depended on the terrain, I suppose.
The nature on it was probably about the same distance as the water platoon was away from the front line, I would think. Probably about 200 or 300 yards.
And behind the hill where you on the reverse side of the hill?
Yes. Sleeping accommodation, etc.
You said that you got involved with the soldiers. Did you
call
any
particular soldiers you went on? Well, the highlight, I suppose, yes.
How did that come
about? Well, the CEO wanted first of all to get a prisoner. And that was the whole aim of the fighting patrol, that you go out to get a prisoner. And it was the aim almost throughout the time that we were there, just to get information from them, but find out what. The other thing was that there was a tiny position opposite us, and it was a 133, I think they were on. And in between the tiny position and the next position away from us, there was a long, low ridge. And the CO, I think, was fairly convinced that that was a boundary between two battalions, Chinese battalions. And he wanted that confirmed, and he also wanted find out what was going on in the Chinese line, so that he could mount an attack on them in order to get a prisoner. And it was necessary to find out good start line for the people to attack. So the first thing that happened in that respect was that a patrol was sent out, the Russian patrol was sent out. As it was there, he was an ex-Gurkha officer. He went out and he festooned himself up, and he actually laid up overlooking the Chinese position for a day, 24 hours, behind a tree, behind a bush. He came back with most detailed information. He'd drawn a piece of what was going on with him. A pool or pond down behind at the bottom of the hill, which they used for watching. And it was really good. I admired him, and he already had an MC. I'm sure he would have got another one.
Clark,
that's it, yes. He'd been in the Gurkhas during the war. He'd been in Burma, I think it was. And he's got his MC with the SU. Yeah. And then about two nights after that, I think it was, I was sent out with a firm base to go and recce this ridge. Same time, trying to pick out a decent start line for the assault, and they took me out, and I put them down on the ground, the standing patrol, and Moody and I went off, climbed up the hill. It was difficult that because the silhouette was important, of course, and you weren't sure where you were silhouetted, which side you were. It obviously the right hand side looking at the hill was. We knew there were Chinese there, so we tried to keep just below the crest on this side. If there'd been anybody on the other side, they might have seen us, I don't know. But we did manage to go right along to the end of the ridge and didn't find anything, not even old diggings or anything. And by that time, it was getting on a bit, so I said to Rudy, we've still got to get this start line, so let's go and have a look at that. And so we more or less rushed back and picked what I thought was an adequate start line. And we then went to rejoin the.
Did you mark that with tape?
No, that would have been too obvious. No, just from memory. I was going to lead them out anyway on the actual night to show them where it was.
Moving up down the ridge, was it a bare ridge or was it covered?
It was fairly bare. There were one or two low bushes on it, very low. In fact, that's the low bushes that were Clark had hidden under. Yes, but otherwise it was fairly bare. It hadn't been shelled all that much, actually. But undergrowth by that time was a rather large growth that had been chopped down and used as fuel.
So your descendants came and you might have worked out where the start line was.
Yes. Well, no, we went to the start line and said, right, that will be it. And then we came back to the firm base. And it was getting cold, actually, and they were all asleep, a lot of them. And we had to go around waking them up, so and they were all covered in rime, frost rime. And got them all working up. It took a bit of time for them to sort of come to. It was getting light by that time. So we might have managed to get them all up and moving. And we just got back in time, actually. The first light broke as we were going up the hill. There was one or two mortar bombs fired as well, but we managed to get back to position forward company.
And you went back the same path as you come?
Well, not exactly the same. Oh, to the thing. No, we went as quickly as possible, but it wasn't the same route back. No.
And was this you looking? You didn't go back the same
route? No, yes. You'd be given a way out and a way in and a password that you have to use for coming back in.
Do you remember your password?
No. Bladen was the name of the operation. But I don't know what, I can't remember any passwords that people will particularly use.
And then the operation followed?
And the yes, I don't know. I think it was about two or three nights later. A lad called Pettit was the assault platoon commander, and Moody and I, and I took them out and got them on the start line, and we were just about getting sorted out here from the lines of for the attack. And it looked as though we were going to start late anyway, so I used the telephone as a wireless and said, would you delay Leyden? Leyden doing the operation for the thing to go ahead, naming the operation as well. And I think a bad use of words, I think, was misunderstood. They must have thought that I'd said relay Leyden, because almost immediately a six trace of shells from the tank fired and they're bashing into the Chinese position, which was almost opposite us, and I was trying up.
And how far away were you?
I would think about, as the crow flies, about 20 yards or something like that. Yes. Going up, we had to climb the hill. The sat lands at the bottom, or just off the bottom, and then had to go down and go up again. And so some of them did land in the air, so and the CEO had said to me, we'd had practice, we'd done this practice thing on other hills like the one that we've been used dozens and dozens of times. And I used to go up with them onto the hill in the practice thing. And the CEO, Peter Jeffrey, said, I don't want you to go up on the hill. As soon as you've done this stuff, turn them off, come back. Don't, come up, he says, don't go up. And I said, so. Get an order like that, you don't argue about it. So when I set off, and Rudy and I came back, and we could hear all the noise and that sort of thing. Well, we heard all that were far back now, as far as the time we got to the top of the hill. Further over, the rest of the company was on the firm base through which the assault platoon passed on the way back to their lines, our lines. So the route was up one side, onto the position, mill around for 10, I think it was a 15-minute, and then whatever happened, come off and go out by the firm bay, which was commanded by Pat Donegan, his company commander. And this, as far as I know, happened. We got back, and I said to the first aid post to see what's happening. And they were being shelled, actually. Nobody had been hurt in that thing. And then they began to bring the odd wounded person in. And we thought that everybody was back. And we heard a firing of a dead Sterling in the valley. And it turned out to be Corporal Moore, who was bringing back Bromley, who had been wounded in the leg rather badly. So they went down and helped them back in. And by which time he got in the door at the daylight. And they still shelled. They shelled quite a bit, actually. About 1,000 rounds or something like that was fired at the rest of the main company position.
Did you get
a prisoner? No. They'd been pre-warned by the six shells that had plowed into the hillside, and that all. By the time the SOP team got up for the position, they were all underground, and they were pulled up. So there was nobody, they just milled around looking at the position, seeing if any sort of anybody stray hanging around. They didn't go in because it wasn't, first of all, it was time, it was unnecessary danger, really. So on that point of view, it was unsuccessful, but they did take and hold the position for as long as they were on it, about 20 minutes, I think, altogether. All right. So
that Chinese position was pretty
strong, wasn't it? Oh, yes. And they were well tunneled, if you will. They dug under and used to bolt underground. We did it eventually in various positions, face to face, like the hook, where you just all went to ground as soon as the shelling of the position stopped came out. And they were doing the same. They did the same. So they just stayed there until the platoon had gone, and then came back out again. There was more shelling from us as well, of course, once they were off the position. parrot got the formation in this factory. I think we should really have got an MC, because the trouble was at that stage is that we were still in the last war, you know, and I hesitate to say this, but what it means that the standards were still high. I mean, in the war, it had to be practically got a BC to get an MC, you know, or do a BC thing. I think those sort of standards with the battalion being fresh and most of the senior officers being ex-wartime people, they considered that he'd done a good job, but not that it was MC standard. So he got a mention in his factory. Pellet was a little bit upset. He seemed to be living on his nerves for the rest of the time. He left to come home a couple of months after that, before he went to quite 2-1-0. I think it upset him a bit. The last time I saw him actually was a reunion down in London of the 150th anniversary or whatever it was, one of the anniversaries, and he was an absolute wreck. I got a mention as well.
You
were
mentioned.
Yeah. Was there any propaganda that going on in the Chinese? All sorts. Signs stuck up saying, you know, what are you doing fighting for the Americans? And leaflets that left on the wire or thrown through the wire. Tannoy system. They used to work in said cheerio to when they left the line and walked them back in when they came into all that. They knew we were coming and they knew we were there, you know. Welcome to DLI. Why are you still fighting for the Americans? The imperialists and others, probably. We've got one or two people got, they've got some in the museum, the type of propaganda that was put out. Montages of photographs which show the woman, you know, defending a baby from a very great big American Negro or somebody, you know, who was trying to have his way with her, sector. That was very crude stuff. We did the same thing, I suppose. We used to send over official passes for anybody who wants to desert from there to come across the West and it would be safe conduct. You know? But it was all very crude and just laughable, really, that people took absolutely no notice of it. But still, you kept the collected stuff.
So no one came over from the
Not to my knowledge, sir. It was very difficult to get a Chinese. We did actually capture two. One of them, a chap called Margaret, he got a Chinaman who virtually willed himself to death. You know, by the time they got him back to the line, I think he died. He'd been wounded a bit. Been wounded in his vein or something, but he didn't want to live. Eventually we were in the front line on the next, 210. Yes. We were up front there.
Operation Willington,
was that last year? Yeah, that was Bob McGregor opened with that one, yeah. It was the same hill actually that we did the hill which proved to be empty. And right next to it was a low spur which had a digging on it, you could see it. So Lucia wanted to know whether it was occupied. Bob McGregor took a fight to go back, and it was completely unoccupied. That was really good.
And that was another country?
That was, yes. Oh, wait a minute. No. No, it was their country. Yes, Bob McGregor was the nation. Yes. Wasn't it?
I think D-Company in the diary. Yeah.
The D-Company? Oh, well, that's the diary would be right, not me. Just that I seem to recall talking to Bob as though he was But anyway, yes, he was at that time thinking about becoming a regular.
He was one of the National Service.
He was a National Service. Yeah. All the junior officers were National Service. Yes, that was Bob, yes.
Who?
Wellington. Wellington. No, there was nothing there. It was empty. That was all the woodsmen, but they wanted to know whether it was occupied or not.
How were active
Chinese shipments more than the other ones? Indiscriminate, I think, so. Mostly, largely. It was annoying, that's more. You never knew whether it was coming across and it was explode. One or two, but the Australians, whenever they were shell, they still watch it. You know, I mean, they're about half a dozen casualties because of this. But we used to just, you know, better get on with it and go and sit in our hoochies. Well, apart from the observation, we kept the observation trench in mind, and that sort of thing. But as far as the reverse side of the hill was concerned, you're always liable to happen to me once the shell landed on the top of the hoochie. But fortunately, it was by that time it was all the reinforced hoochies, and it was the O group, the command post, that was hit. And it was like being inside a gun. I think that might have been one of the reasons why I'm in death now. But it really did stun you.
It wasn't
considered, you know, dangerous to the fact that it was indiscriminate. I mean, everybody would have been hurt by it. Just a good. They take it for a part of the first time they were a little bit nervous about it, you know, and I think when it was going on they were very nervous, but they were sensible and kept on the cover, and very few casualties occurred. We did get some. Sean was one of them, of course. Of course, Sean was one of these. He was up in the splinter, Thomas Guy. Well, they were a problem, but they kept as far as they were a little bit badly marked. The mine fields were always accurate, and there'd been some of them had been there so long that the mines themselves had slipped and sort of wandered off down somewhere else, especially on the hillside. The only experience that I had with mines was later on at 355, the first night